Hi everyone, I'm Lula.
And I'm Jude.
And welcome back to Just
I mean,
Friends.
Lula, this is the craziest episode. Like, I cannot believe we have this guest for our season finale, like final guest, right? This is season two
Yes,
finale guest.
I know. Okay, should I do the intro?
I cannot wait. Yes, please.
Okay. Today, we are talking to Violet Vintage, who I had the absolute pleasure of meeting at one of her talks at the PIC, otherwise known as the Prostitution Information Center here in Amsterdam's Red Light District. Violet Vintage is a sex worker herself, and her sheer openness to share and excitement about the topic made it clear that she would be perfect to have on the pod. Violet, we are so thankful that you're here.
I'm so thankful that you wanted me to come and speak here today. Thank you for inviting me.
We're here on like a Tuesday, Wednesday. I don't even know what day it is. Early morning, like kind of delirious, but so excited.
Okay, so I haven't met you yet. So could you give me like just a brief introduction of like what type of sex work you do and how you got into sex work as like the industry?
Yeah, so I work in what's known as the online can by minute work. So this is where you log into a chat room and you click on a picture of one of the people that you would like to have some time with, and then as soon as you click, you start paying by the minute. There are three different options to this. You can either be a guest, which means you're in a room with lots of other people and paying a reduced fee, or you can be a private guest, which means that you are paying, but you have to be aware that other people are still watching. And then you can be an exclusive guest where it's just you and me, but obviously that is the top price tier. So I got into sex work during the COVID-19 pandemic. I was in a situation where I was running out of money, and I had previously, before going to university, worked in adult social care and didn't want to go back into that during the COVID pandemic. So I thought, okay, well, how can I make money in a way that's going to keep me safe during the pandemic? And while in-person sex work was in low demand, cam work, OnlyFans had hit a market peak during the pandemic. So it was a great time to jump on the wave that created. So I spoke to a friend who is a mother of three and does it in her free time, and got some tips from her about how to get started. And then just thought one day, okay, I'm going to give it a go. And it took 2 weeks for me to get approved. So you have to go through like a verification system to make sure you've not been exploited in any way. And then you can get started. And yeah, I've been doing that ever since.
Will you walk me through how it felt on your first time when you log in and it's your first like show? Like, what was that experience like?
Yeah, so I think there's definitely like a moment where you're kind of masking up, so to speak, where you're getting dressed and getting your makeup on, and you kind of decide what kind of character are you going to go for. Some sex workers get more into this than others, but for me personally, I'm in my own life, I'm very academic, geeky, love a jumper and sweatpants combo. But it in my working world, I'm very much a Marilyn Monroe stereotype with blonde curly hair, vintage underwear, and a very sultry phone voice that people very much like. So I think the first time I was extremely nervous because I just had no clue what's going to happen. You know, it's like chat roulette. You don't know who you're going to get on the other end sometimes. But also kind of calmed myself by realizing if I don't like this, I can stop at any point. And I never have to do it again. There's no contract. You're a completely self-employed person. You can decide if you want to keep going on. And there's a computer screen between me and the person. So there is that element of safety where you can say, nope, press the red button and stop the interaction. And then as soon as I got talking to my first person, I just blurted out straight away, was just like, this is my first time doing this and I'm really nervous, which they loved. because everyone wants to be someone's first time. And yeah, and it went really well and lasted for, 5 minutes. And yeah, I thought, oh, okay, that's easy. And now I've got 25 euros in my pocket. So let's keep going. And yeah, and then did that for 2 hours on my first night and walked home with, 450 euros in my pocket for 2 hours of work. It's not a bad day.
Not a bad day at all.
Great first day.
Yeah.
Interaction is 5 minutes. What are you usually doing, or what does it usually involve?
Yeah, so most of the time, you, especially in my line of work, you want to keep people online as long as possible because the money's rolling. So usually in 5 minutes of interaction, I do a slow striptease. There might be some sort of gentle flirting involved. And I would never have someone come on camera and say, put this vibrator in yourself straight away. Like, that's not how I do it, because I'm not having them log out after a minute and being like, right, okay, that's only 2 euros 20 in my pocket. So there is kind of, if you're going on cam services, you are kind of having this kind of slow, drawn out girlfriend experience almost. So yeah, usually if 5 minutes, it's a bit of a striptease, it's a bit of gentle flirting, maybe some light masturbation, but not more than that really. But I think, especially if it's someone's first time logging on, they are so excited by the fact that, they kind of have this ability to ask someone to do things and they're happy to do it, that they just get too excited and they're gone.
Do you ever have people just want to talk to you?
Yes, all the time. All the time. I had one client who was a little old man in his 80s whose wife had dementia, and he just wanted someone to talk to. And he would literally pay for me to just lay on the bed, almost like we were like laid side to side together, like on a pillow, and just talk to each other. And maybe once or twice he'd be like, can I just see one boob? And I'd think, of course you can. Like, you've just been here talking to me for 45 minutes. But not every time. Sometimes he was literally just happy with the talk. But sometimes he's like, just one boob. Which is fair, I think.
And like, he has his needs.
Yeah, exactly. And, he's been polite enough, Not that, you put niceness in and you get sex out, but if you are polite to me, then I'm happy to show you a boob. Yeah.
So obviously there are a lot of different types of sex work. Why did you gravitate towards the cam setup?
I think the first time I truly thought about doing sex work was probably when I was around 16, actually. I think I've always had quite a good understanding of sex as an exchange, and an understanding of relationships as an exchange, and I've also been quite open-minded about sex in comparison to my upbringing, which was very Catholic and very Jewish. Mum's Jewish, dad's Catholic. So I grew up with kind of very moralizing ideas around sex, but really rebelled from that at every point possible. So I actually thought when I was 16, how much money could I potentially get for my virginity? Because I thought, I'd had friends who had lost their virginity and had, said it was no great task. There was no, like, we'd been lied to. It wasn't any great kind of romantic moment. And I thought maybe I could, make some money out of this, but didn't in the end. It was more of a kind of passing, fleeting thought. But then I think at other points in my life, because I've always worked in care and adult social care, which doesn't make great money, there had definitely been points where I thought, oh, okay, well, if I just do this one time, but had always either been in relationships that weren't very happy with the idea of me doing that, or kind of backed out at the last moment because I'm 5'1" and I'm about 90 pounds when wet. So even though there are sex workers who are my size and are badass and don't take any shit, me personally, I struggle with setting boundaries when the camera isn't in place. Mm-hmm. So I thought it's probably not the best option for me to do that type of work. Not because there's anything morally against it or stuff like that, but simply I don't have the boundaries to make it very clear what it is I will and won't do in that setting. I can do it very well online, but in person, I feel like it's a different thing.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Could you talk a little bit more about the relationships that are just like more romantic relationships in your life and how your work has affected them? I mean, more specifically, I'm curious about like if your understanding of sex as kind of a more transactional experience reemerges in those romantic relationships.
I think sex work really taught me how to better articulate my needs in a sexual relationship, and really got me to realize actually how much I, not just sexually, but emotionally, romantic labor is involved in a relationship, and how much you're kind of, you know, when I look back on some of my relationships and think, fuck, I gave that away for free and I asked nothing for it in return, whether that's money, whether that's support, love, whatever. And it really got me to reassess that and to be clearer in my relationships about what the boundaries are and about, you know, articulating my needs. So I think a lot of people come away and think, oh, well, sex work, you know, disassociates women, and it's always women people are talking about, from their bodies. It you know, it makes them cross boundaries that they wouldn't do in a normal relationship. And I actually argue the opposite. I think often the majority of us are compromising ourselves romantically, sexually, emotionally in our relation, our romantic relationships, rather than being as strict as we are in our transactional relationships. And therefore, I think it's made me a better partner personally, because I can articulate better what I need, but I'm also way more open to what someone else's needs might be now and the psychology behind them. Because you come into contact with all kinds of fetishes, all kinds of needs and wants through this work. And rather than kind of reflexively going, oh, that's weird, I take the time to be like, where does that come from? Where has this need or want, where does it derive from? Taking my time to ask clients that if they're happy to talk about it. And I think that's really important if you're getting into a new relationship, because one of the most common things that people have said to me when I've been working is, I love my partner, but they don't understand why I need this. Or, I love my partner, but I'm too embarrassed to tell them that I have this fetish, which I think is really sad, because I think that I would like to think that more often partners would be really understanding if there's something that you need of a relationship. And maybe I think it's the fear that people have of telling their partners sometimes rather than the actual potential of being rejected. And I don't want to go into it too much, because if people don't do that, then I'm out of a job. But it's interesting to me that the blame is often put on sex work for why people behave in certain ways, rather than seeing sex workers as people who see people at their most vulnerable and help them to come to terms with their sexuality and their emotional insecurities.
Wow. I think that a lot of the content of sex that people see, whether that be porn, romantic comedies, novels, whatever that is, they don't do a great job showing those vulnerable conversations typically. And they don't model that. And I'm curious if you have any advice to anyone about how you approach those conversations and how you, because they are going to be awkward. I mean, it's not as sexy as like ripping off your clothes and just like going and having sex, right? Like, it's actually conversation. But like, how do you approach those conversations in a respectful and thoughtful and honest way?
I think that a lot of people, and I think you're completely right. I think the idea of movies and literature retellings of what sex is like always make it out that it needs to be spontaneous, and you should just be able to feel what your partner wants, which is ridiculous because as a doctor, I can't feel what is wrong with my patient. Like, I need them to communicate with me. And I think that's very much the same in relationships, both what I have done online, but also in my romantic relationships, of you need to sit down and create dedicated time to talk about what it is that you would like romantically, sexually. And if you're in a position where you feel like you can't articulate what it is that you want, because sometimes we don't even know what it is we want, we just know that something's missing. I would say, go online, do your research about fetishes, have a look on BDSM forums. The internet is full of descriptors of what you could be wanting sexually. I think we also live in a society where we expect one person to be able to fulfill all our needs as a person. And I think that's also selfish, because that then puts a lot of pressure on one person to fulfill absolutely every need, whether that be social, romantic, financial, etc. So I think sex workers are also very good at having those conversations as well about, you know, and like you said, movies portray this idea that one person can be our everything. And I think that's very toxic. And that's very dangerous, because if something were to suddenly happen to that person, what would you do? I see it quite a lot in my line of work where, an old man's wife has died and he's never learned how to do the cooking. He's never learned how to do the ironing. Or the vice versa. The husband dies and the wife's never paid taxes before. So, you know, to rely on someone that entirely is dangerous. So I think that you just need to sit down and have these conversations about, can your needs be, one, met by this person? Two, what are your needs? And three, is there any way that you can come to an agreement that either someone else will fulfill those needs, or you will find some sort of self-fulfillment, you know, for those needs, you know, which most people are doing anyway. They're just not telling their partners about it. You know, most people are watching porn and hiding it, or most people are dressing up in their wife's underwear and not saying anything about it. It's, you know, it's going on anyway. It's just whether or not you can be honest about it and talk to the person about it. And if you can't, then you need to reassess your relationship. But that's just my idea.
I really like your idea. I have a question that might not be fair.
Okay.
So I don't know. This is, I guess, also maybe not entirely agreed upon by everyone, but I don't consider porn cheating. And I think hearing you said something, I think, two responses ago to something Jude asked about people logging on with you and their partner either not knowing, or like they're trying to figure out what they might like kind of with you instead of their partner, et cetera, which obviously I think means there's some issues there, but, or they're in a process of discovery, whatever. Do you consider, or I don't even know how to phrase this, do you think that sometimes people who engage with you are cheating?
Absolutely not. I don't consider it cheating, because to me, it is a financial exchange which is going on, the same way as you pay for porn online, or the same way that, you know, if you go to the Windows and you spend time with someone. To me, that personally is not cheating, because cheating for me, and everyone has a different interpretation of this, but cheating for me is going and having a relationship or seeking sexual fulfillment in a way that deliberately, how do I word this? So when you go and cheat with someone that you've met in a club, that is, to me, very different than paying for a service. So therefore, I don't find what I do as cheating. Or if you go off and you're having an affair with someone, that's very different, I find, than watching porn online or what I provide. Because there is never the potential that there is going to be a relationship with me. There is never the potential that there is going to be a relationship with the porn actress or with a window worker.
It's so, and I'm not, yeah, I have to grapple with this more. Like, this is going to take me a while. Because hearing you talk, I think what came up with me is that hearing you talk about what you do and what your side of the transactions and the work is, I would never say that, like, you are involved with someone who is cheating. But it's much more intuitive for me to be like, if someone that I am monogamously seeing is talking or masturbating with or having sex with someone else, it's much easier for me to see that as cheating. I think that's where my head went. But it's really interesting because there is obviously a separation.
So no, for me, the cheating comes from the lying. I think if, and I guess it's difficult to ask in situ, but I think if your partner came up to you and said, look, I have a real thing with feet. It's something that I need to express. It's something that I need to gratify. But you, for example, hate your feet being touched. And your partner says, but I absolutely love and adore you, but you have, you know, this is something that I need. And you came to an agreement that, okay, well, you know, there's going to be foot porn on his computer, or, you know, more ethically. And this is the thing I think that people sometimes forget, is that we're quite okay with the idea of people watching free porn, but we're not okay with them paying for it. But free porn is often stolen, and the content creator has no idea that their porn has ended up on that website. So to me personally, I would much rather have a partner who pays for their porn, and therefore I know the money is going to the person who created it, than stealing someone's porn for their own gratification. But I think it's something we struggle with. We struggle with that idea of being okay with, okay, well, my partner spends this much on porn, either each month or each year. Whereas when you're not spending money, you can be more secretive about it, because there's nothing going to show up in your bank statements. And the idea that we need to pay for something to fulfill our sexual fulfillment is something we struggle with as well. Why can't you just get it? Why do you need to pay for it? And this is even worse for women, I find, because we live in a world that says, well, you're a woman, why do you need to pay for sex? Yet I know countless women who have had very ungratifying sexual experiences, either with one night stands or with long-term partners, and those problems would have been solved if they just paid someone to give them exactly what they wanted.
Why do you think that is? Because I think humans have no issue paying for every other need, you know, like they pay for food so they can eat. Like, why is it that sex and money is so taboo?
I think especially in the West, we have a framework that sex is sacred. You know, sex should be protected, sex is coveted, and money is, you know, something that is in the public realm, whereas sex is in the private realm. You know, so when you cross things that are meant to be in the public realm, like work, money, casual social relationships, with what is considered private, so intimate relationships, sex, and, you know, other things, people get conflicted by that. And I think there's also an element of, if you have to pay for sex, then is it completely done of someone's free will? That's often the argument I have to deal with at the PIC, is, you know, are people doing it because they like this work, or are they doing it for money? And I think it can be both. I think very few of us work because we like working. You know, it's kind of like that TikTok video where it's like, I do not dream of labor, you know? And I think all of us are like that, but it's this idea of, oh, well, if you wouldn't have sex with that person for free, if you're having sex because of money, then therefore it must be exploitative. But I wouldn't have done any of, and people are conflicted by this, people hate it when I say this, but I wouldn't have done any of my care work if I'd had to do it for free. Why would I? Why should I sacrifice my time, my effort, my empathy for someone who doesn't see the monetary value of it? I wouldn't have done any of my work at the PIC if there wasn't some sort of contributing factor to it. I love the job. I love what I do. But I live in a capitalist society and I have to pay rent. So it's very much that thing. And I think it's, we can't look at sex work the same way as we look at other work and understand that people shouldn't have to work out of the goodness of their hearts all the time. And I think this is where, here we go, I'm back round to the fort now. This is where I think, because sex is very much seen as women's labor, all of us are engaging in sex, but it's very much viewed as women's labor, like cooking, like cleaning, like childcare. We don't want to pay women for these things. And sex falls into that as well. And I think that's why most of the ideology around anti-sex work focuses on women, doesn't focus on male sex workers, which are more exposed to violence than women's sex workers. It doesn't focus on trans women sex workers, which are more exposed to violence than cis women sex workers. It focuses on this idea of the vulnerable woman who would have been better staying off at home than she would have been going out into the working world and trying to make her own way.
That was like a mic drop moment. That was, yeah, like you just expanded my mind right there a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, can I segue us a little, Jude? I'm like, Jude has to take that all in.
I'm just sitting with it for a second. But yes, please segue us.
So we're kind of talking about the pick more, which is where I said at the very beginning that that's where I first heard you talk. Can you share a little about how you got to the pick, why you work there, what you do there, maybe even like how you got to Amsterdam? I know this is kind of backtracking a little, but I feel like I have lots that I'm eager to talk about with like window working also in general.
Yeah, no. So I started working at the Prostitution Information Center back in 2020. Oh, when was it? 2022. I came from the UK to do my research on the red light district in Dublin. I focused my master's research very much on red light districts, feminist geography, and also power and knowledge distribution amongst sex workers. So yeah, pretty much went into my master's and was like, sex worker, academia, that's what I want to do. So then I was looking at different places that I could potentially do a master's work placement. And yeah, the PIC just ticked all the boxes. It was right in the center of the red light district. It was a sex worker led organization. And also, I had also fallen in love with a Dutch man, so it was perfect timing. So I contacted them and just said, this is what I do. You know, would you be interested in hosting me for 4 months to do ethnographic research? And they said, well, we don't usually allow students to do this because obviously we don't want sex workers feeling uncomfortable in the space and feeling like they're being researched. But because you have a history of working as a sex worker, we are willing to see if this works. So that's how I started working with the Prostitution Information Center. And after I did my research, there was an opportunity to apply for the coordinator position. And I did it practically just to get interview experience. I really didn't think I was actually going to get the job. And then I did. So I had a moment of being like, yay. And then thinking, fuck, I need to figure out how to move to this country, which I'm still figuring out.
What do you do? Like, I don't know what PIC actually does on like a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, no. So what we do is our main ethos is to answer any question that comes through the door about sex work. So this can be from a student, a client, a sex worker, politicians when they dare to walk through the door, and we really have the mission of providing people education that allows from sex workers that allows them to understand that sex work itself is not violent. but the stigma that people hold against sex workers causes violence. So we do that through a manner of ways. We have just general walk in and ask a question. We also do walk and talks for the public, which is like a lecture followed by a self-guided walk around the district. We do student lectures, and we also have education and neighborhood events as well. And also through our sex worker archive as well, which is a project I started when I first came to the PIC, of collecting different heritages and histories of sex work in the area. It's by no means a complete collection and never will be. And unfortunately, there are people's stories who are missing from the archive more than people's stories who are included. But it gives a sense that sex work is not something that kind of happened as a phenomena, and it is not something that didn't influence the city as well. So yeah, those are the different things that we do. There's more that I could list off, but those are kind of like the general things we tend to day to day.
Do you mind, I hope this isn't too repetitive for you, but do you mind sharing some of the safety measures that window workers have? Because I think when I heard you talk, that was one of the biggest, I don't know, I feel like that was one of the most impactful things that I heard in terms of like checking my own bias about the red light district in Amsterdam and kind of how it works. Because I think also maybe if you could talk about, this is true, but I feel like the inner workings of window workers is not widely known. And I'm also wondering if that's purposeful or if it's like people just don't inform themselves and the information is out there. Sorry, that was a lot of things.
No. I'll try and answer all of them. And if I forget anything, remind me if I've dropped anything. I think I'm going to do it backwards.
Okay.
I think that a lot of the time, it's not because sex workers don't want people to know what the safety measures are. We would prefer people knew what they were, so they knew that if they were coming to the windows, like, you were going to be spotted by that camera, there is that alarm bell, and there are five sex workers behind here, so be careful. But I think it's more because people have a very one-sided view of what the windows are. And often people aren't asking the question, what are the safety measures in place? They're automatically going to that place of, this must be exploitative. I can't imagine myself stood in the windows. Therefore, there can't be anything safe about this. So you can find that information. It is available online, and there are papers written about it. But people, I often use the analogy that often people look in the windows and see a mirror, you know, and they can't imagine themselves working in the windows, or they can't imagine someone they love working in the windows. So therefore, it can't be of benefit to anyone. But the safety measures that we have in place in the windows, I categorize into physical and structural, institutional and community based. So in terms of physical and structural, the buildings in Amsterdam the windows are all purpose built. They are built for the purpose of being windows, and therefore they all have doors that can only be opened from the inside. They only have an inner door that can be opened from the outside so that the client can't lock you and themselves in the bedroom together. There are always sex workers working in a row together. You are never by yourself, and there is an interconnected corridor down the back that people are not usually aware of. There are 4 to 5 alarm bells in each room strategically placed. So therefore, if anything happens, the window operator has to respond within a very short time period. And because it is a legal and regulated form of sex work, the police are readily available if necessary as well. And I would say 99% of the time take the side of the sex worker, not of the client, which then ties into the community safety, because you as a sex worker know that local residents, the window operator and the police are all on your side. So sex workers in the red light district in Amsterdam have an upper hand when it comes to the power dynamic in comparison to the client. Mm. and clients are aware of this, and they're usually extremely well behaved. We've not heard of a violent incident happening in the windows for years.
Wow.
We've heard of them happening outside the windows. So when people have taken clients home because of the changing window times, or sex workers who have been mugged on their way home carrying cash. But they don't happen in the windows that often because there is this community structural surveillance going on. And if you behave badly in the red light district, there are consequences, which then means at an institutional level as well, you have the support of the police. You also have services in the area, such as social support, legal support, and health support for sex workers, that make it a really great place to work. You've got transportation routes that can get you anywhere you need within 5 minutes. So you can come in and out of the city centre without anyone noticing you. It's great for clients as well, because clients are shy creatures. So all of these factors lead to the red light district being voted the safest working space for sex workers by sex workers in the Netherlands. And it's just really sad because we're seeing the disappearance of windows across the Netherlands, even though they're voted the safest working space.
Why are you seeing the disappearance?
I think because different municipalities, they see the windows as something medieval, as something that opposes women's rights or is anti-feminist, rather than a safe workspace. I think in Amsterdam in particular, there is a municipality shame towards the windows as something that shouldn't be going on anymore. And therefore, they prefer sex work to happen behind closed doors, out of sight, out of mind. Which is actually more dangerous for sex workers. When you push sex work beyond the human perception, then that's when dangerous things happen. Rather than accepting it as part of life. And it's a really conflictual form of sex work. You can't avoid it. It's right in your face, and people are conflicted by that. So I think they want to give way to more quote unquote modern types of sex work. Especially in Amsterdam, there's also an association with it being tied to bad tourist behavior, which we know is not true, because one, sex workers don't want drunk or drugged up tourists. Two, we know that 90% of tourists would still come to Amsterdam if there was no windows. And three, when we look at London, Paris, or Barcelona, which all have tourism issues, they don't have active or visible red light districts. So it's kind of a false assumption, but all of these factors are tied together in this idea that windows are no longer something that the municipalities want in the Netherlands, which is really, really sad, because I actually think it's a, as well as it being a sex working space, and isn't it great that we have one which is so public, it's trying to erase a very Dutch part of history in the Netherlands.
I was going to ask if you could speak more about the clients. I think it's so, not like funny is the right word, but when you say like shy clients, it's so, I think that's a whole other level of like destigmatizing what goes on in the red light district. I mean, I would say, you know, I've walked around the red light district before, and especially being there at night, I would say like 90% of the men that I see go up to windows, walk away.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I don't know. The shy client thing sticks out to me.
Yeah, well, I think that going up in a very public setting and admitting that you want to have sex with someone is hard, you know. We often need a lot of alcohol inside of us and a dark club room to have the courage to do that. And the thing is that sex workers have the right to reject you as well. You know, they can turn around and say, no, I don't want to have sex with you, or no, you're too drunk, you're too drugged up, or I just don't like the look of you. And that rejection is scary. So I think being publicly rejected, or the potential
of being publicly rejected in that way, because usually sex workers are quite discreet about it. They won't publicly humiliate someone, but the fear that that could happen does create shy clients. And I think because clients also suffer from a lot of self-stigma, they don't want to be, you know, creepy, pervy men, which is often what we see the client being represented as in media and literature. They're usually very lonely and very intimacy deprived people who just want to have a connection with someone. And even admitting that you're lonely as a man, and I say men only because 90% of those visiting the windows are men, admitting those things feels shameful. You know, I feel like as women, we're socialized more to be able to say, I'm lonely and I need intimacy and I need emotional support right now. But a lot of men, that is a sign, you know, it's portrayed as a sign of failure. So I think that's where the shyness comes from. One, the need not to be perceived as creepy or perverted. Two, the embarrassment of admitting that you're lonely or deprived. And three, we have this perception that if you can't get sex for free, then you have somehow failed. There is something very brave in admitting that this is what I want sexually. I cannot find it in an intimate relationship. Therefore, I'm willing to pay someone to provide me what I need. That takes a lot of bravery.
I'm playing with this paradox in my head of how typically the stereotypical client is portrayed as kind of hyper-masculine and in some ways toxic masculine. Yet what we're talking about is a lot of these clients kind of, or the people that come up to the window and kind of run away, it's actually them feeling insecure with their masculinity and being like, oh my God, I can't be lonely. Like, I need to fulfill that desire. And I'm just curious, like, how you've come to understand specifically masculine nature, but human nature through your work.
I think that even though I don't like to say sex workers are therapists or social workers, because I feel like that kind of de-verifies our work, but a lot of the work we do is social based and therapy based, and we see people at their most vulnerable. We see people when they are at a point where it's like, this is what I would like sexually, please can you provide it for me? You know, that takes a lot of vulnerability. I have come across both older men who are lonely and don't feel like they can say that they're struggling with their mental health, and I've come across young men who feel insecure because for some reason they just don't know in today's society how to go about finding someone and losing their virginity. And there is so much pressure on young men to lose their virginity by a certain age. And if you can't approach a woman and have sex with her, then what are you doing as a man? That's kind of the perception that's given across. But also denying the fact that we've moved into a digital world and we are losing our ability to socialize with people, which then understandably people are looking for a safe space in which to practice intimacy. And sex workers provide that, and I've provided that. I've had clients who have, you know, had practice relationships with me and have reached a point where they're like, actually, I found a girlfriend now. I'm not going to be paying you anymore. And while I'm sad because it's like, fuck, there's my income. But at the same time, I'm also glad for them, you know, that they found that and I was able to provide that. We need sex work in this world. We need and we need to be more accepting of it. I think we often have this image in our head of what sex work looks like. And it's often this hyper pumped up masculine man snorting cocaine and absolutely pounding a sex worker from behind. That is the image that comes into people's minds. And then when people think about that taking place in the windows multiple times a day, you know, they think, God, that must be such an awful experience for that sex worker. But that's very rarely what's going on. It's not to say there aren't clients like that, and it's not to say that there aren't sex workers who are happy to do that. But the majority of the time, I would say 90% of what we do is intimacy work, and 10% of what we do is penetrative sex. And it wouldn't matter if it was the other way around either, but I think people's lack of understanding of what sex work portrays leads to these incorrect views, and the media is also to blame for that, of what sex work looks like in those rooms, which is usually portrayed by people who have never been in those situations, who have never seen a sex worker, who have never paid to have an intimate experience with a sex worker. So therefore, these incorrect portrayals come about. And that feeds, while I would argue the stigma towards sex workers is more important to address, if we don't destigmatize the client as a monster, we can't destigmatize the sex worker as a victim.
This is
third mic drop of the episode.
This is crazy.
Sorry.
No, it's great. I'm like, half of this is Jude and I left like speechless, rethinking our whole lives.
I wasn't coming into this conversation, I think, with a lot of stigma, but I do think that especially towards the client, I do have stigma. And I guess like naturally because of that, it does rub off in some ways in my understanding of sex workers. I have a final question.
Okay.
Which is kind of a silly one, but what sex advice would you give to college students?
There is no silly question at the PIC. So I think, first of all, don't take sex so seriously. You are going to have lots of crappy sexual experiences, but you need to have those crappy sexual experiences to find out what it is that you want. I got to the age of 26 before I realized, right, this is what I want during sex, and I'm not willing to settle for any less. I think explore. I think have sex with as many people as you can, because you're only young and beautiful once. And body count means absolutely nothing as long as you're being safe. You know, so also third bit of advice, use protection.
Safe sex is,
you know,
sexy.
Sex workers. Exactly. Sex workers in the Netherlands have a lower rate of STIs than the general population. And that's because they constantly use contraception. The amount of young boys I've had come in and say, oh, yeah, but what are my chances of catching an STI from a sex worker? And I have to tell them, you're more likely to catch an STI from a girl you meet in a club than you are from a sex worker. So take the advice from sex workers, use your contraception. And yeah, just don't worry about what other people think of your sexuality or what you're interested in. And if you are sat up thinking at night, I'm interested in something weird and people are going to shame me for this, everyone is into something weird, and you will find your tribe of people who are into weird stuff. And there is no fetish that I've ever come across where I think, oh, that's completely unique and I've never heard of that before. No, everyone, we're pretty predictable as a human species, and you will find someone who is into your kink. And if you struggle to find that person, then don't watch free porn. Pay someone, either to talk online or pay for your porn, and be an ethical sexual consumer.
Wow.
And with that.
Yeah, what a wonderful conversation. I like am beyond appreciative that you're willing to talk to us, and just, I don't know. We got to talk about this stuff more. Like, that's that is the takeaway.
We do.
Like, because it shouldn't be this taboo.
To all the listeners, hope you left with new knowledge and excitement about sex or relationships or love and everything and anything. Like, that's my closing words.
Well, as always, we love to hear from our listeners. So if you have any thoughts or questions, you can contact us at the Just Friends Pod on Instagram or through the Spotify comment section.
And if this episode resonated with you, we would love it if you share with someone who you think would enjoy it, who you want to have sex with, you don't want to have sex with, who you once had sex with and wish you didn't. Someone you just like as a person.
Literally anyone. Okay. Well, with that, thank you so much for listening, you all. We will see you next Sunday.
Love you.
Bye.